content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the August 18, 2025 issue of the New Yorker. Why hasn't medical science cured chronic headaches? More than 1.2 billion people worldwide suffer from migraine and other debilitating conditions that are understudied and often not taken seriously. By Jerome Groopman. 2 decades ago, I was leaving my morning clinic at the hospital where I work when I suddenly felt an excruciating pain in my head. It was as if my skull were exploding while simultaneously being gripped in a vise that was getting tighter and tighter. I became nauseated and dizzy and made my way unsteadily to the emergency room. I was in my early 50s, and my first thought was that this could be a burst aneurysm, known to some physicians as the worst headache of your life. To my relief, a CAT scan showed no sign of bleeding in the brain. And then came the bad news. A neurologist arrived, examined me, and said he thought that I was suffering from a migraine. I had never had one before, but his diagnosis turned out to be correct, and, since that time, migraines have been an indelible feature of my life. Their frequency and severity have varied over the years, but once you become a migraineur, as doctors sometimes call us, you are always wondering when your next attack will be, planning how you might strategize around it, scrutinizing your life for possible triggers, and looking for some new treatment that might curb the agony. As Tom Zeller Jr. writes in The Headache, published by Mariner, the unpredictability of chronic headache conditions is particularly unnerving for those who suffer from them. You may be delivering a speech before a large crowd, cooking dinner for a friend, or simply lazing alone on a hammock staring at the sky. You may even be sound asleep when it happens. At any moment, it can appear, creeping in like a shadow in some cases, ambushing like a predator in others. Zeller, a science journalist, does not get migraines. He suffers from something generally acknowledged to be even worse, cluster headaches. Often, featuring in lists of the most painful conditions in medicine, along with trigeminal neuralgia, sciatica, and gout, cluster headaches are named for the way that they descend in clusters several times a day. The intensity of the pain is reflected in another name for the condition, suicide headache. Zeller describes the pain as white-hot, blinding but invisible, frantic but elephantine, and writes of writhing on the bathroom floor, of spittle and drool, of fingertips ground furiously into the scalp in a futile attempt to soothe whatever shrieking complex of anatomy is tearing at the right side of my head. Cluster headaches are relatively rare, affecting less than 1% of the population, whereas migraine is among the most common serious maladies. Globally, some 1.2 billion people suffer from it, some 40 million of them in the United States. Men are more likely to experience cluster headaches, whereas female migraine patients outnumber their male counterparts at a ratio of about 3-to-1. The two conditions provide the focus of Zeller's book, which weaves together history, biology, a survey of current research, testimony from patients, and an agonizing account of Zeller's own suffering, which began when he was in his 20s. Readers with migraine or cluster headaches will find themselves, as I did, comparing their own experiences with the rich material in the book, which is both a survey of the field and a great cry of pain. Migraines vary widely from person to person in terms of how they are experienced, what seems to trigger them, and how responsive they are to various drugs. They may begin in adulthood, as they did in my case, but they can also afflict children. More than half of women with migraines suffer attacks during menstruation, suggesting hormonal fluctuation as a trigger. Migraines may be preceded by a variety of subtle symptoms. Zeller lists constipation, food cravings, frequent yawnings, stiffness in the neck, or increased thirst and urination. There is also the phenomenon known as aura, an array of sensory or motor symptoms that often portend the onset of pain, nausea, and a heightened sensitivity to light. Aura is one of the most striking features of a migraine, but only about a third of sufferers experience it. I am one of them, and my experience is intensely visual. Before my headache arrives, there's a kind of flashing light in the shape of a crescent moon with saw-like teeth, and this apparition gradually expands until it blocks the vision in my right eye. Oliver Sacks, in his masterly first book, Migraine, from 1970, includes paintings by various migraine patients of their auras. One that looks very much like mine bears the caption, "A classical zigzag fortification pattern. Its brilliance in life is as dazzling as a white surface in the noonday sun, and the edge is in continual scintillation." Some relatively lucky migraineurs get aura, but no pain following it. But for most, both with and without aura, the attacks are debilitating. During and after, I need to rest in a dark room. Even a glimmer of light is painful, and I feel physically and mentally spent, unable to function for the rest of the day. Migraines typically affect one side of the head. Indeed, etymologically, the term comes via Latin from a Greek word referring to this hemicrania, which lost its initial syllable as it passed from language to language. The condition has been recognized through most of recorded history. Hippocrates described what appears to be an aura. He seemed to see something shining before him like a light, usually in the part of the right eye, he wrote of a patient. A violent pain supervened in the right temple and then in all the head and neck. Artaeus of Cappadocia, thought to have lived in the 2nd century CE, possibly at the same time as Galen, described a headache disorder similar to my experience. These were bouts of head pain involving much torpor, heaviness of the head, anxiety, and weariness. Patients fled light because the darkness soothes their disease. A remedy recommended by Galen involved applying a torpedo fish, a member of the Ray family, to the heads of sufferers, a treatment that Zeller speculates may have served as a counter-irritant. Artaeus favored bloodletting, cupping, blistering, and, if all else failed, a gruesome cauterization of the scalp. The occurrence of chronic head pain, doubtless, goes back much further. Zeller observes that the portion of the population experiencing migraine and other headache disorders appears to be remarkably stable, neither ebbing nor flowing very much over time, and with only small variations across ethnicities and geographies. This suggests that the problem may be as old as our species. He spends several pages outlining the practice of trepanation, drilling a hole in the skull, evidence of which has been found in skeletons dating back to the late Paleolithic, some 12,000 years ago. He cites not only historians and medics who take this as confirmation of early headache treatments, among them the 17th century Dr. Thomas Willis, who coined the term neurology, but also those who persuasively argue against that assumption. Still, he admits that his sufferings predispose him to think there must be something in that idea. Anyone who has experienced the pain of a cluster attack will have at least contemplated an act of self-violence commensurate with trepanation, he writes. When there is a terror unfolding inside the skull, how crazy is it to think that another terror might let it out? For most of history, there was little advance in the treatment of headaches and a corresponding curiosity about what might work. Charles Darwin, himself a sufferer, recorded in the journals documenting his time aboard HMS Beagle a folk custom that had been shared with him during a bad bout in Argentina. A common practice is to bind an orange leaf or a bit of black plaster to each temple, and a still more general plan is to split a bean into halves, moisten them, and place one on each temple, where they will easily adhere, he wrote. If a man with patches on his head is asked, "What is the matter?" he will answer, "I had a headache the day before yesterday." Medical science may have had little to offer headache sufferers, but, as Zeller notes, prior to the 20th century, unexplained head pain was considered a consequential matter, a mysterious and even baffling affliction that warranted serious medical consideration, accumulating documentation, and frequently dramatic interventions. An important theme running through his book is the scant attention these conditions now receive, given how many people suffer from them, and the difficulty that patients have in being taken seriously. There are far fewer caregivers and researchers tackling the headache conundrum than there are working on movement disorders such as Parkinson's, degenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and vascular maladies such as stroke. Patients seeking solutions often experience frustration and desperation. They visit neurologists, anesthesiologists, pain management specialists, alternative healers, and online chat groups, trying to find explanations and relief. Sufferers have also long been stereotyped by doctors, a tendency exacerbated by the fact that migraine patients are predominantly female. Zeller quotes an interview from the 1940s with Walter Z. Alvarez, a prominent physician on the staff of the Mayo Clinic. Quote, "Women who are most easy on the eyes, charming, dazzlingly intelligent, and highly sensitive, are the very ones who are particularly prone to attacks of migraine headache," end quote. Joan Didion addressed this denigrating view in her essay, In Bed. She wrote, "All of us who have migraine suffer not only from the attacks themselves, but from this common conviction that we are perversely refusing to cure ourselves by taking a couple of aspirin. You don't look like a migraine personality, a doctor once said to me. Your hair's messy, but I suppose you're a compulsive housekeeper. Actually, my house is kept even more negligently than my hair." The question of what causes migraine and other chronic headaches is controversial, with two schools of thought, both of which can be traced back to the 19th century. One school contends that migraine is primarily an abnormality of the blood vessels and targets treatment accordingly. This is what I was taught in medical school nearly 50 years ago, and one of the first neurologists I consulted, noting that I would get a migraine while resting on Shabbat after a stressful week, suggested that my blood vessels, which had been tight and constricted, were relaxing, causing excessive blood flow into the brain, and thus the headache. It occurred to me that one solution might be never to relax. His advice for prevention was vigorous exercise to enhance vascular tone, a regimen that, in my case, didn't work. The other camp holds that migraine emanates not from blood vessels, but from the brain itself, like epilepsy. In a phenomenon known as electrical depolarization, an abnormal flux of ions triggers neurons to fire, moving up from the brainstem and into regions including the cortex. This mechanism can account for such symptoms as aura, nausea, photophobia, and tingling, and the weight of brain scan evidence favors this hypothesis. Those who subscribe to it see blood vessel contraction and relaxation as mere epiphenomena. Zeller offers a useful synthesis of the two views. If one were to boil down existing knowledge of primary headache mechanics, these three statements would more or less cover it. 1. Key parts of the brain seem to be involved. 2. Certain neurochemicals seem to be important. And 3. We still aren't entirely sure about the role of blood vessels in the whole matter. Depending on the doctor and on the theory that he or she held, I have been prescribed various medications, sometimes in sequence, sometimes in combination. I began with tricyclic antidepressants, which years ago were found to be helpful for some migraine patients, but they affected my blood pressure. If I got up quickly from bed, it dropped to the point that I'd almost faint and also made it hard to urinate. I moved on to verapamil, a drug that blocks calcium's entry into the smooth muscle cells around blood vessels, causing the vessels to relax and widen. It made my vascular tone and blood pressure plummet. Next was Topamax, an anti-epileptic medication whose nickname in medical circles is Dopamax, because it makes you feel stupid. Indeed, I felt as if my head were filled with potatoes. I could barely think and could speak only slowly. I then added propranolol, a beta blocker that reduces the effects of adrenaline on the heart and the blood vessels. It also brought on a degree of fatigue and gloom that became intolerable, a known side effect of the medication. During acute migraine attacks, I took triptans targeting the neurotransmitter serotonin, which ameliorated the headache in the short term by blocking pain receptors in the head. But triptans can be taken only in limited doses because of their risk of inflicting rebound headaches and their side effects of nausea, vomiting, and chest pain. One weekend, in the midst of this trial and error of remedies, after stopping propranolol, I had an explosive series of unrelenting migraines, each episode dovetailing into the next. There was a brief respite of an hour or two between waves of aura and pain. I couldn't leave my darkened room and feared I would be consigned to a life of debility. A neurologist prescribed high doses of prednisone, a corticosteroid, which broke the vicious cycle but induced severe anxiety and insomnia, so much so that I had to take lorazepam, a Valium-like benzodiazepine. None of these numerous medications were consistently beneficial. Zeller aptly captures my experience when he writes, "What works for one person today may not always work, which will force them to seek out a new remedy from a well of options that necessarily shrinks with every change." His own pharmaceutical quest is nothing short of hair-raising. The book opens with him high on psilocybin from magic mushrooms. He writes of a time when, working on a big story for the Times, he was ingesting high doses of magnesium, inhaling up my nose regular squirts of water and capsaicin, popping calcium channel blockers like candy, and practically mainlining caffeine, which sometimes seemed to abort an individual headache if taken quickly, but also probably helped to make the headaches worse overall. At one point, he blacks out from taking too much verapamil. I registered an abiding sense of thanks, not because I'd survive a reckless overdose, but because I had finally slept through the night without a headache. Despite our limited understanding of the biology of chronic headaches, there have been recent advances in identifying molecules in the brain which mediate pain. The discovery of a neurotransmitter called calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP, has markedly advanced the understanding and the treatment of migraine. This discovery came about when researchers inserted cannulas around patients' fifth cranial nerve to sample the release of proteins during migraine and found CGRP in abundance. It was released from trigeminal nerve endings surrounding cranial blood vessels. Subsequent experiments found that intravenous infusions of CGRP invariably produced migraines. Drugs developed to block the effects of CGRP arrived for patients in 2018. I was initially prescribed Aimovig, an antibiotic that is self-administered by injection once a month. For 8 months, I didn't have a single migraine, having previously averaged one every few weeks. At first, I thought I might be among the lucky 20% of patients whom Zeller describes as super responders. Their lifelong personal narratives of disabling, unexplained, recurrent head pain being completely rewritten in ways that would have been wholly unheard of just a few short years ago. Alas, for me, the effects of Aimovig gradually waned, and I became despondent. Fortunately, another CGRP-targeting drug came out on the market, Emgality. This worked for me too, but again, the benefit wore off after about a year. Both Aimovig and Emgality were prescribed for me by a pain specialist. When they stopped working, I saw a neurologist who was in the migraine as epilepsy camp. She recommended Lamictal, an anti-epileptic medication that is also used for psychiatric conditions such as bipolar disorder. It suppresses electrical depolarization and has been shown to be highly effective in people who have migraine with aura, but not in those who have migraine without aura, a fact that lends credence to the hypothesis that aura represents an epileptic-like event in the brain. The benefit for me was substantial and has been ongoing. Meanwhile, the pain specialist I was consulting encouraged me to add on a long-acting CGRP antibody called Vyepti, which is given every 3 months. Sometimes during the week or two before my Vyepti infusion, I feel tingly in my neck without the flashing light in my eye, but with moderate one-sided head pain. I've come to think of this as a mini-migraine. Immediately, I take Nurtec, another CGRP blocker, which can abort a full-blown attack. The use of multiple medications is common among headache sufferers. One study cited by Zeller found that the average patient was taking at least 4 medications and that 40% were taking 5 or more. Lamictal, Vyepti, and Nurtec are all preventative. During a full-blown attack, I take triptans. Why are migraines such a common part of human experience? Zeller notes that animals do not seem to suffer chronic headaches. I've never seen one of my pets lie in its bed with its paw over its head, an Australian pharmacologist tells him. This may indicate that migraines are produced by the interaction of the most primitive parts of our brain and the cortical structures that have evolved more recently. Zeller suggests that evolutionary biology may hold an explanation for chronic headaches. It's not hard to imagine that an acutely sensitive nervous system, attuned and highly responsive to sounds, sights, smells, and threats, would be valuable to our primitive forebears on the predatory savanna, he writes. Maybe the desirability of these triggerable, keenly attentive senses meant that our internal wiring would evolve to a razor's edge, forever spring-loaded, but prone, in some of us, to errant firing under the wrong conditions. This hypothesis sounds persuasive, albeit frustrating for me. We are no longer on the predatory savanna, and I, for one, would prefer to have a nervous system that was not on a razor's edge requiring multiple medications to restrain it. Still, with the 4 drugs I now take, migraines have lost much of their power to dictate the shape of my days. I suffer the full force of one only a couple of times a year, with many migraines marking the waning of my quarterly infusions. For me, that's a huge improvement, enough to move through the world without the old dread always trailing behind. Reading Zeller's book, I was reminded that there is a kind of uneasy fellowship in this condition, a vast, involuntary community of people mapping out their lives between attacks, haunted by uncertainty, but sustained in part by accounts like this. If there's a lesson here, it's that pain resists mastery, but understanding, however incomplete, can offer its own form of relief. And now, from the May 23, 2019 online edition of The New Yorker, the invisible city beneath Paris. Under the southern portion of the city exists its negative image, a network of more than 200 miles of galleries, rooms, and chambers, by Robert McFarlane. The map runs to 16 laminated foolscap pages, or about 10 square feet, when I tile the pages together. I have been given it on the condition that I do not pass it on. It is not like any map I have ever seen, and I have seen some strange maps in my time. The plan of the above-ground city is traced carefully in pale silver-gray ink, such that, if you read only for the gray, you can discern the faint footprints of apartment blocks and embassies, parks and ornamental gardens, boulevards and streets, the churches, the railway lines, and the train stations, all hovering there, intricate and immaterial. The map's real content, the topography it inks in black and blue and orange and red, is the invisible city, the realm out of which, over centuries, the upper city has been hewn and drawn, block by block. This invisible city follows different laws of planning to its surface counterpart. Its tunneled streets often kink and wriggle or run to dead ends. Some of them curl back on themselves like whips. At junctions, three or four tunnel streets might spray out. There are slender highways running almost the length of the tiled map from southwest to northeast. There are inexplicably broken grids of streets or hubs where the spokes of different tunnels meet. Coming off some of the tunnels are chambers, irregular in their outlines and with dozens of small connecting rooms. The map's place names traverse a range of cultural registers, from the classical to the surreal to the military-industrial. The Room of Cubes, the Boutique of Psychosis, Crossroads of the Dead, the Medusa, Bunker Under the Mountain, the Monastery of the Bears, Osa Arida, Room Z. Affordance is specified on the map in handwritten cursive words, low, quite low, very low, tight, flooded, impractical, impassable. More detail is occasionally given, humid and unstable region, sometimes flooded, beautiful gallery, vaulted and corbelled, Chatier, cat flaps, mark a point of lateral transition between tunnel and tunnel, or between tunnel and chamber. Other captions gloss contact sites between the upper city and the invisible city, hole to the sky, or between levels, tiny hole in the ground debouching into a dangerous lower level. Scattered around the map are little inked skulls and crossbones, laconic warnings of danger, cave-in, open well, dangerous, collapsing ceiling. Here and there, boxed-out cartouches offer stories of individual sites. A blue compass rose with an orange northward arrow is laid over an empty section of each page, and each page is given a district name. The typeface is a fine serifed font that I do not recognize. The overall aesthetic is coolly contemporary, the cartography itself an elegant compression. Authorship is attributed only to a collective called Nexus, the connection or connections between the parts of a system or a group of entities. I admire the work of its anonymous makers. On the day we first go down into the invisible city, castle clouds mass over the lowlands to the north of our entrance point. Flat fields, square steepled church towers, lines of poplars, red-tiled farms. My last sight of the sun is a westerly blaze under rain clouds. At dusk, we push through a door in a wall marked Interdit d'Entrer, slip through a hole in a chain-link fence, scramble down to a railway line, and crunch along the tracks toward the brick arch of a tunnel. The cutting banks are tangled with acacia trees and wild clematis. Apartment blocks rise above the cutting on both sides. Once in the railway tunnel, we keep between the tracks, because what little light there is glints on the metal and shows us the way. Ahead in the darkness is a flock of fireflies, soft orange lights bobbing in the black air. We draw closer, and bodies gradually attach themselves to the lights, which are the bared flames of carbide lamps mounted on people milling around one side of the tunnel. They are standing around, smoking and talking, carbide canisters belted at their waists, with pipes leading up to burners strapped to their heads. From the burners hiss the two horns of orange flame, low in temperature but high in luminosity. They nod greetings to us, murmuring in French and English. Down at track level, where one side of the tunnel begins to rise, is a ragged hole in the ground, just wide enough to admit a person. A few yards to its right, I can see the outline of what had once been a similar hole, now plugged with fresh-looking concrete. I have come to the catacombs with two friends. Let us call them Lena and Jay. Jay is a caver, keen to extend his explorations into city systems. He is droll, unflappable, and strong. Lena is the leader of our group, and she has been here many times. She is passionate about the catacombs, especially about preserving and documenting their swiftly changing features through photography and record keeping. She wears bright lipstick, and she ties her curly brown hair back to keep it out of trouble in the tunnels. Below ground, she is calm and cool in her decision-making, warm and generous with her knowledge and her sharing of this space. Without Lena's trust, I wouldn't be able to access the network, as she refers to it. I feel fortunate to be with her. The cataflicts came down and filled that one up, Lena says, pointing to the plugged hole at track level. So the cataphiles lit a fire to soften the stone and then used pickaxes to open up this new one. It's probably the safest way in and out right now, but we'll plan to exit by a manhole whenever we come out. She gestures back up the tunnel with a smile and then eases herself feet first into the ragged hole, raises her arms above her head, and disappears. All cities are additions to a landscape that require subtraction from elsewhere. Much of Paris was built from its own underland, hewn block by block from the bedrock and hauled up for dressing and placing. Underground stone quarrying began in the 13th century, and Lutetian limestone was used in the construction of such iconic buildings as the Notre Dame Cathedral, the Louvre, and St. Eustache Church. The result of more than 600 years of quarrying is that beneath the southern portion of the city exists its negative image, a network of more than 200 miles of galleries, rooms, and chambers, extending beneath several arrondissements. This network is the vides de carrière, the quarry voids, the catacombs, which together total an underground space around 10 times the space of Central Park. Quarrying techniques changed surprisingly little over time. Shafts were driven 60 feet or so down to the limestone layers. Then tunnels were cut laterally from there, following the strata. Where larger rooms were excavated, pillars of stone were left unquarried to support the ceilings. The standard tunnel was cut to 6 feet high and 3 feet wide, enough to accommodate a man pushing a barrow filled with stone. Dynasties of quarrymen came and went, passing down skills from father to son, extending the maze. For centuries, quarrying was ill-regulated and largely unmapped. Then, in the mid-18th century, the extensive undermining began to have consequences for the upper city, causing subsidence sinkholes known as fonti that were reputed to be of diabolic origin. The quarry voids had begun to migrate to the surface. The undercity had begun to consume its twin. In 1774, a fonti engulfed, in a matter of seconds, pavements, houses, horses, carts, and people. The site of the sinkhole was, of all places, the Rue d'Enfer, the Street of Hell. Several minor cave-ins followed, and panic spread in the city at the unknown extent of the invisible danger. Louis XVI responded, shortly after his accession by creating an inspection unit for the quarries below Paris and surrounding plains, headed by a general inspector named Charles Axel Guillemont, and tasked with regulating the quarries for the purposes of public safety. It was Guillemont who initiated the first mapping of the void network with a view to consolidating existing spaces and regulating further quarrying activities. A subterranean town planning system was established whereby chambers and tunnels were named in relation to the streets above them, thus creating a mirror city with the ground serving as the line of symmetry. Paris has another Paris under herself, Victor Hugo wrote in Les Miserables, of the sewer system, which has its streets, its intersections, its squares, its dead ends, its arteries, and its circulation. It was also Guillemont who, in the mid-1780s, oversaw the idea of using the quarry voids for purposes of storage. And what urgently needed storing was Paris's dead. The city's earliest significant burial grounds, established during the Roman era, were located on the southern outskirts of the city as it then stood. But as Paris spread, it took to burying the majority of its bodies in cemeteries within its bounds, notably in the main cemetery of Saint-Innocent, near the central marketplace of Les Halles. The result, over centuries, was a growing glut of the dead. Saint-Innocent became the resting place for millions of bodies. The Parisian dead were pressing hard upon the Parisian living. In 1780, a basement wall in a property adjoining Saint-Innocent gave way under the weight of the mass grave behind it, and bones and earth spilled into the space. A radical solution was clearly needed to this problem of overpopulation. So started one of the most remarkable episodes of Paris's history. In 1786, the process began of evacuating the city's cemeteries, crypts, and tombs, and transferring the remains of more than 6 million corpses to the quarry region known as the Tombe Issoire, soon to become Les Catacombes, on what was then the Montrouge Plain. A grim, ritualized production line was established for this task, involving diggers, cleaners, stackers, drivers, porters, and overseers. Every night, for years, horse-drawn funerary wagons containing the bones of the disinterred dead, covered with heavy black cloths, preceded by torchbearers and followed by priests who chanted the mass of the dead, clopped through the streets from the cemeteries to the Tombe Issoire, where they disposed of their contents. Down in the tunnels, workers sorted the remains of the dead, filing them by bones into space-sufficient ricks and stacks. Minor forms of folk art emerged in the disposition of these bones, serried ranks of femurs, their gleaming lines separated by rows of skulls, all turned eye sockets outward. The deposition of bones into the catacombs continued over the course of the 19th century, but quarrying dwindled away as the best limestone deposits became worked out. Adaptable quarrymen made a career moving into farming, renting out some of the quarry voids as mushroom fields. Damp and dark, these spaces provided the perfect growing spaces for champignons, which sprouted from rows of horse manure. During the Second World War, the French resistance retreated into sections of the tunnels in the months following the occupation. So did civilians during air raids. And so, too, did Vichy and Wehrmacht officers who constructed bomb-proof bunkers in the maze under the 6th arrondissement. After the war, the cult of the catacombs began to grow. Increasing numbers of people were drawn down into them for purposes of concealment, crime, or pleasure. These users of the network became known as cataphiles, lovers of the below. In 1955, access to the catacomb network was made illegal, with the exception of a small area of show ossuaries that were kept open for purposes of tourism. Attempts to police the space were formalized. Specialist police, quickly nicknamed cataflicks and catacops, were trained in the network's geography. Barrier walls were built across many subterranean routes, and the entrances to the network, tunnels, gates, manholes, were welded and locked shut. But the cataphiles kept coming. for the labyrinth offered a space where Paris's subcultures could go to grow. It became, and still is, what the anarchist theorist Hakim Bey calls a temporary autonomous zone, a place where people might slip into different identities, assume new ways of being and relating, become fluid and wild in ways that are constrained on the surface. The arrival of the internet further boosted cataphilia. Chat rooms and websites enabled cataphiles to share and curate information about the network. Cataphiles went by subterranean pseudonyms online, Styx, Charon, and mildly fetishized the pseudo-covert nature of their activities. An unofficial cataphile uniform declared itself: thigh-high waders, small waterproof backpack, hoodie, and head torch. Serious cataphiles carried manhole cover keys on their belts. There was a street of cafes and pizza establishments where it is usual to see dozens of people in dark green waders waddling down the street or sitting at cafe tables, like a convention of trout fishermen far from any river. A commune culture emerged with its own honor codes. The rules were few and clear. Respect the past of the catacombs. Take out what you take in. Resources are to be shared, even with strangers. No selling and no buying. Barter, exchange, or gifting are the only acceptable modes of transaction. Help is to be given wherever necessary. Create with care and do not destroy. Some of the cataphiles went down to party. Others, though, became fascinated by the layered histories of the space. An unofficial University of the Catacombs was established, dedicated to the restoration, preservation, and mapping of the network, and to the formal archiving of its stories. Once, a pop-up cinema was established in one of the chambers, and themed films were shown over several weeks. Vertov's Man with a Movie Camera, Lynch's Eraserhead, until it was shut down by the cataphiles. New rooms continue to be dug by cataphiles, and new nameplates added to tunnels. Work groups are established to add fresh layers to the catacomb palimpsest, large graffiti murals, new carvings, a sword buried in a stone, or mosaic works involving thousands of tiles. The further in we get, the better the wall art gets, Nina says. We have come feet first through the ragged hole and dropped into a tunnel, its ceiling sturdily arched. The limestone walls writhe with graffiti. Antifa slogans, zombie skulls with popping eyes, tags, names. In the Salle de Vague, you'll see Hokusai's wave. We need to keep moving. It's good not to linger near the entrance. Plus, there's Banga to negotiate first, which will slow us down. Banga? You'll see. We need to find somewhere to sleep tonight in the next few hours. We've a long day moving north tomorrow, which may well bring some obstacles. I like the sound of sleep. I am exhausted by nerves and travel. Lena leads off, Jay follows, and I bring up the rear. Lena moves fast, settling to a quick march down the dry tunnels. You have to move quickly if you want to cover any ground. Get far in, she calls over her shoulder. Soon, the floor of the tunnel begins to muddy up and then dips into black water. Welcome to Banga, Lena calls over her shoulder. It acts as a kind of airlock or waterlock and stops most people who get this far from coming any further. She wades into the murky water. We follow. It rapidly deepens to waist height. Our head torch beams bob on the water. Feel at the edges of the tunnel with your feet, Lena says. You'll find there are ridges there you can walk on. She's right, and this lifts me further out of the water, but moves my head closer to the ceiling. I have to crook my neck as I edge on through the water, which presses cold on my legs. We slosh past flooded junctions, with tunnels cutting at a perpendicular to ours. I glance left and right. They disappear into darkness. I am beginning to comprehend something of the extent of the system. The water level lessens, then shallows to nothing, and we are on firm ground again. Lena increases our pace. She doesn't pause at junctions. She takes turns without hesitation. We have been moving for a couple of hours when Lena stops, checks a mark on the wall, and turns into a narrow side tunnel. "Down here," she says, "this is where we'll sleep. It's called the Salle de Huître, the oyster room. The quarrymen used to shuck oysters down here as their food while working." 20 yards down the tunnel is a roughly square hole cut into the right-hand tunnel wall, about 4 feet off the ground, and about a foot and a half across. "Welcome to your first châtier," Lena says. "Châtier means cat flap, as well as something a bit less polite than that. There's a technique to getting through them. I'll try to show you." She posts her pack through first. Then she leans into the châtier as far as she can go with the top half of her body, feels backward with her feet until she reaches the far wall of the tunnel, and then walks her feet blindly up the wall, bracing her body until she is horizontal, head and shoulders in the châtier, feet against the far wall. Then she bends her knees, braces, and kicks off the wall like a swimmer doing a turn in a pool, driving herself into the châtier and pulling herself onward and through. "After you," I say to Jay, bowing. He mimics Lena's technique perfectly. Of my own entry, well, let me say only that it is far less elegant and far more painful. I pull through and find myself in a low-ceilinged room, 5 feet high at its highest, with chisel marks visible on the stone. The main chamber has a stone table thick with white candle wax. In its center stands a plastic bong, bubblegum pink and shaped like a foot-long penis. Oyster shells have been arranged around it. The floor is covered in small spill heaps of gray powder, the spent waste from carbide lamps. Leading off the chamber is an open doorway to a neighboring room, off which another room leads. We explore the rooms, a dozen or so, roughly organized around a supporting central trunk of stone. "People will probably come to use the party space later in the night," Lena says. "If we want any sleep, we should get as far from it as we can." So we set up camp in a distant room. Its ceilings are low, 3 or 4 feet high at the most. We move about it on hands and knees. The air swirls with rock dust, which I can taste on my tongue and feel on my eyes. The upper city seems very distant. I crawl to the back of the room and find that it extends into a low cave-like space, a couple of feet high and wide enough for a body. I settle down for the night there, oddly comforted by the sense of enclosure. 60 solid feet of stone extend above me. We talk for a while in the candlelight, struck into closeness by the oddity of our dormitory. Then silence falls as tiredness does, with stealth and force. Late in the morning, we drop down a set of stone staircases, moving between levels of the labyrinth, to a point named on the maps as the Bone Well. Lena points to a low tunnel leading off the main passage, an access at it perhaps 2 feet high. "Through there," she says. "You go first, Rob. You'll need to lie on your back to make it." I lean back, reach under and ahead of me, find the at its edge with my fingers, pull through, look up, and am stopped dead. I am in a vertical shaft, and above me is a suspended wall of clay and earth, perhaps 10 feet high, into which hundreds of human bones are embedded, skulls, ribs, and limbs. In the belly of the well below are hundreds more fallen bones. It is a point where a burial ground has begun to disgorge its contents down through a breach in the tunnel network. The rough limestone from which the shaft has been hewn is also visibly thick with bodies, whelks and spiral shells that are embedded, uncrushed in the stone sediment. And I have a sudden sense of both cities, upper and lower, as a single necropolis. Lena and Jay pull themselves one by one into the bone well. Afterward, we speak little as we continue to traverse the passageways. In that region of the catacombs, bones are profuse. There is no order to death here, no names or memorialization, just containment. Occasionally, We pass under a vertical circular shaft leading up through bedrock to a manhole cover in the street. Some have ladder rungs. I pause under one and can see distant glimpses of light, hear faint clanks as the cover is moved by the footfall of pedestrians going about their upper world business. Once, in a long and boneless tunnel, I see flames flickering far ahead of us. Then the flames abruptly disappear. Lena sees them, too, but when we reach the point of their vanishing, there is no side tunnel into which they could have turned. The lamps of other cataphiles, Lena says uncertainly, though I don't see where they could have gone. Then she smiles. Oh, perhaps the ghost of Philibert Asper. Asper became lost down here in 1793, and his body was not discovered until 11 years later. As such, he was arguably the world's first and one of its worst urban explorers. The approach to the Salle du Drapeau, the room of the flag, is the only time when I feel real fear in the Parisian catacombs. It is early evening in the upper city by the time we get close to the room. On the surface, people are leaving offices, walking home through dusk streets, boarding trains and buses, stopping for drinks in bars. Down in the invisible city, we are heading northwest along a tunnel with no side turnings, the ceiling of which is dropping steadily lower. I walk with a bent neck, then with hunched shoulders. Then I have to lean at the waist, and then at last I have to drop to my knees and can only crawl forward. Ahead of me, past Lena, the tunnel seems to cinch to a dead end. I wait for Lena to admit that she has at last led us the wrong way. Lena says nothing. The yellow of the limestone ahead glows in her torchlight. She shrugs off her pack, pushes it behind her, loops one of its straps around one of her ankles, and then eases herself headfirst into what I now see is a tiny floor-level opening, perhaps 18 inches high, where I thought the tunnel ended. My heart shivers fast and my mouth dries up instantly. My body does not want to enter that opening. You'll need to pull your pack along with your toes here, Lena says. Her voice is muffled. And from now on, don't shout or touch the ceiling. Fear slivers up my spine, spills greasily down my throat. Nothing to do but follow. I lie flat, loop pack to foot, edge in head first. The clearance above is so tight that again I have to turn my skull sideways to proceed. The clearance to the sides is so scant that my arms are nearly locked to my body. The stone of the ceiling is cracked into blocks and it sags around the cracks. Claustrophobia suddenly grips my full body like a vise, pressing in on my chest and lungs, squeezing my breath hard, setting black stars exploding in my head. A flooded tunnel leads toward a chamber. Cries come through the doorway, and there is the sound of music, the jams going underground. The doorway opens into a high-sided room, the roof 20 feet or more above us. The space above makes my head feel as if it's helium-filled, floating. A big tricolor flag is painted high on one of the walls, and there are people standing up to greet us, embraces for Lena, shakes of the hand for me, and Jay, welcoming smiles for us all. We have found our way to Wunderkammer, filled with music and hospitality. There is a table spread with food and drink, fruit baguettes, wheels of brie and camembert, bottles of spirits, cans of beer. A boxy CD player sits in the middle of the table, wired up to two small speakers. The jam changes to Bowie's Underground. Ça c'est le cataboum, one of the strangers says, pointing at the music box, nodding in time to the beat. A plastic glass of vodka is pressed into my hand, and I knock it back gratefully. I catch myself grinning. I feel grateful for this place, for the juxtapositions of the catacombs, tilting from terror to warmth in the twist of a tunnel. Introductions are made. There are two French cataphiles who go by handles I do not catch, and a Canadian named T, who is an old friend of Lena's and who works as an au pair during the day and comes down into the catacombs often at night. Bowie changes to Underground by Ben Folds Five. Everyone cheers. We eat, drink, and talk, Hours pass. I mostly listen, relaxing after the day's exertions, pinching myself at the wondrously weird subcultures of this underland, reflecting on the bizarre cultural recyclings that it calls out. Much later, Lena J and I set off to find a sleeping place. We reach a zone called the Air Raid Shelters. A wide tunnel avenue is lined with a series of hooped, semicircular chambers with reinforced ceilings. They are of Second World War origin, Lena says, shelters adapted to resist bombfall. Now they make ideal dormitories for tired cataphiles. The next day, we are ready to leave the Invisible City. After long hours of tiring travel through tunnels from the far northwest of the system, we return to our point of entry. We reach the access hole and climb, one by one, up and out into the train tunnel. After our days of confinement, its ceiling seems as huge as a ballroom. Away to our left is a familiar arc of light. We crunch back down the railroad track, and the upper world moves into view. A pigeon glides, stiff-winged, across the arch-framed sky. Steep sides of the cutting show themselves, acacia branches leaning in from the banks to drop their butterfly leaves. We stop at the point where the light meets the shadow. Look up, and there is the impossible sun. We speak quietly to one another. Our hair is pomaded with sweat and stone dust. The air smells of cucumber and smoke. In one of the apartments, high above us, a woman is hanging white sheets on the balcony. We walk on, scrambling up the cutting side, through the hole in the chain-link fence, out by the doorway marked Interdit d'entrer. On a street corner, three turns from the doorway, a woman stops us to ask if we have come from en bas, from underneath. And yes, we say, we have. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.